Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi, folks. It's Peter Bregan. So glad to have the most informed audience in the world on the subject of psychiatry, psychology, mental health, really the whole human services, human nature, huge arena of thought. And don't forget that my book, still not got it up on the intro, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, How to Overcome, How to Understand and Overcome Your Negative Emotions. And don't forget that there's my free article up on my website, right at the top and in the latest happening section. You can download that for free. It's published in Medical Hypotheses about the biological evolutionary origins of guilt, shame, and anxiety, how they have functioned probably for a couple of million years in our development from hominids to human beings as a kind of anger control mechanism, how they get stimulated in childhood, how flawed they are in our adult lives, how little help they give us, and how we need to just replace them with reason, love, and other positive values. So psychology is not turning out to be extremely excited about the idea of a new concept of an actual evolution, a biological evolution of our inhibitory emotions. Yet I think it's inevitable and scientifically true. Emotions are very much like instincts. Their responsiveness is built in and then, of course, vastly modified by our experiences and ultimately vastly modifiable by choice and reason. My guest, are you there, Paula? Paula? I do not seem to be connecting to my guest.
Oh, yes, I'm here.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm here.
All right. Oh, thank gosh. I was getting ready to start frantically instant messaging my engineer. Paula Kaplan.
Hi.
Did you hear my little intro? You're actually here?
I did, yes.
Okay. Well, Paula is just a remarkable human being. Somewhere along the way, she and I lost personal track of each other. We're going to have to find out why. I don't know exactly how that happened. She's just really remarkable. We have a lot of similar interests. So listen to this list. She's a PhD, and she's does clinical research, clinical work and research work. She's an activist. She's a social justice advocate. She's a human rights advocate, nonfiction writer, and an award-winning playwright. I once got an award for one of my plays, Paula, but I can't call myself.
Oh, I'd love to see it. I didn't know.
And I have two published novels, and I'm working on a novel right now. My big project right now is a novel. I'm not a screenwriter. I wanted to be, but I never made it. I'm not an actor. I would have loved to be, and I never made it. And I've never been a director. She's currently an associate at Harvard University's, is it Du Bois or Du Bois?
They pronounce it Du Bois because that's how W.E.B. Du Bois pronounced his name.
Okay, yes. And I have a kind of familiarity with who he was. He was actually one of the very early black radical folks who actually wanted to set up a place in Africa for the slaves, if I remember correctly. Is that right?
You know, what I know about him is that he talked about the importance of black people having rights and having power and not giving in to the way that they were treated and to make sure that there were black people leading the way in making change. He was quite something.
Yes.
And what I've been doing at the Du Bois Institute, actually the Oh, so sad. The Julian Bond, who recently died, had inspired a study that I designed with him and then carried out through the Du Bois Institute. And it was just documenting the ongoing terrible racism and sexism on college campuses, on predominantly white campuses. And the report of that came out recently, and we're just delighted to see that a lot of change is happening as a result of that report, especially at Missouri State University in my hometown of Springfield, Missouri, where they were one of the institutions that participated in the study, and they then moved to make enormous changes all over campus in all sorts of realms. And they have students, a lot of black students who come from St. Louis, which is where Ferguson is. So it's turned out to be all the more important for them to have done this great anti-racism work as well as the work against sexism.
Where do people get your report?
Oh, in a journal called Aporia, A-P-O-R-I-A, and the subtitle of the journal is The Nursing Journal. And if they Google that and Voices of Diversity, they should get that. It's a wonderful radical journal. Dr. David Holmes was head of the nursing school at the University of Ottawa, and he created the journal, and he's the editor-in-chief. And he also, you'll love this, Peter, you too should meet if you haven't yet. Dr. Holmes edited a book called Power and the Psychiatric Apparatus. It's a great title. And it's a great book. That's how I met him, was because he asked me if I would write something for his book.
Email me sort of an introductory email. Let me tell folks more about you, too, because I didn't really get finished there. Okay. I mean, you've really done so many different things. She's been chosen. I mean, one of the things is that she's managed to do something that's very unusual, which is to be really a truth seeker and speaker, and at the same time to keep at least a foot or so in the academic establishment. She's chosen as an eminent woman psychologist by the American Psychological Association. She's the author of a book that had a big influence on me. Both your books influenced me, those early books, The Myth of Women's Masochism and Don't Blame Mother. Yeah, they should be they should be on everybody's reading list. And her latest book of many books is When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help Veterans. Now, most recently, writing in that same journal, Paula Kaplan, that's Kaplan with a C, C-A-P-L-A-N, mm-hmm. PhD, she's written an incredible article, the best article, exposing Alan Francis, the editor-in-chief of the DSM-IV and the Johnny-come-lately critic of psychiatry. So let's give the mic back to you now, Paula.
You want me to talk about what was in that article?
Wherever you want to go right now. I'm happy to have you talk about the article.
Let me just give a little bit of history that provides some context for that article. In 1988, I had been involved in the previous years in trying to prevent Robert Spitzer, who was head of DSM-3 and 3R, from putting some really appalling categories in his edition. And after it was published anyway, Ben Alan Francis became the head of the next edition of the DSM, which was to be the fourth one. And I called him and I said, I was interested to see that that Robert Spitzer had put these two terrible categories, which were premenstrual dysphoric disorder and self-defeating personality disorder, in the DSM-3R. And he put them in there under a new category, a new appendix he created that was called Categories Requiring Further Study. But it didn't say, for goodness sake, don't use these categories, because there's not a shred of evidence that they are even real, never mind that they represent what you might want to call mental illness, however you define it. And I said I wanted to review the research on these categories as it came out and share that with him. And he said, well, why don't you join those two committees for DSM-IV? And it was very interesting because I used to be a journalist. I always take notes when I'm on the phone. And I said, well, okay, but I think I should tell you where I stand on these categories. And he said, oh, I know where you stand. But then he said, this is very interesting, listen to the wording. He said, but this time we're going to base decisions about what goes into the manual on the science. And I thought, well, that would be a new thing. Okay, I'll be part of that. And he also said, and this time we're going to have open and honest debate. And I thought, well, that too would be wonderful. Yeah, I'll be part of that. So then I said to him, all right, I'll be on those committees, but I think I should say, if I'm uncomfortable with what is happening, I'll have to resign, and I will feel free to speak publicly about what I've learned. And he said, oh, I'm sure you will. And that's what happened. I was on these two committees. I was appalled by the way they take good science, and when it doesn't, when the good research doesn't fit with what they want to put in the manual, they ignore it, they distort it, or they just out and out lie about it. And then they'll use badly done research, and they'll sort of squish it into support for what they want to put in the manual anyway. So I was just horrified, and I had increasingly started hearing from people whose lives had been destroyed in the mental health system. And as you know better than anybody, Peter, every kind of harm in the mental health system, every single kind of harm, and there are lots of different kinds, starts with getting a diagnosis. Because if they just don't, if they don't diagnose you, they can't administer any kind of treatment, whether it's good or bad. And so I started hearing from people whose lives had been ruined, and it all started with getting one of these labels. And they thought, the people who were harmed said, well, I thought this was scientifically based. That's what they advertise in the DSM, that it's science. And so I was increasingly hearing these tragic stories of harm and telling Ellen Francis about it and telling the other people on the committees, and they just did not care. And they would publicly deny that there was any harm caused by diagnosis. So I just couldn't stay on those committees and in good conscience, so I resigned after 2 years. And I wrote a book about what I learned, which is called They Say You're Crazy, How the World's Most Powerful Psychiatrist Decide Who's Normal. And,
By the way, let me interrupt a second. Folks, that book, They Say You're Crazy, I didn't mention, and it is an outstanding book and really should be part of the reading. So several of your books should be, but in your most recent books, that is such an important book, and was very, very valuable to me. So They Say You're Crazy. Read it.
Well,
thank
you, Peter. That means a lot coming from you, because your books are such classics. But in any case, when I was writing that book, it came out in 95, and, you know, it's about the DSM-IV, but goodness, the same thing's been happening for DSM-5 as well. But when I was writing the book, my editor, I would send her another chapter, and she wrote back at one point and said, you know, Paula, you sound kind of naive, because you keep saying, just when I thought I had learned the worst about how these people operate, such and such happened, you know, and I was shocked. And she said, how can you keep being shocked? And I said, well, I grew up in Springfield, Missouri, and I was taught that authorities are our friends. And, Peter, I really believed that. You know, I thought the teachers are there to help us, doctors are there to help us, the police are there to help us. And so that's sort of my default position. I always assume, not just authorities, I always assume that people are being honest and their intentions are good. And so when I would find out something bad about these DSM people, I was so shocked that I really each time I thought, well, now I know the worst. So the book came out in 1995. And then about a year and a half ago now, so I guess it was in 2014, a colleague called me and said, I have just come into possession of a document that is so shocking. And he said, the world needs to know about this. And he thought I was the person who should write about it because of having been immersed in all the, in the DSM process and so on. And so I started reading it, and it was this report by Dr. David Rossman. And this is what's in that article that you mentioned that, that's called Diagnosis Gate, that just came out a few months ago. And here's what I read. Dr. David Rossman is probably one of the top two experts in the country on medical ethics. And he was asked by the Attorney General of the state of Texas to write an expert witness report. This was for a lawsuit by Texas and a lot of other states, ultimately, against Janssen Pharmaceuticals, which is part of Johnson & Johnson. And these had been in the headlines. Some of the material had been in the headlines already, that Janssen was forced to pay millions of dollars to various states because of falsely marketing Risperdal, this awful, dangerous neuroleptic drug. And there was Medicaid fraud. That was in another lawsuit. And so I had heard about that part. But what was in the Rossman report that I'd never heard of was the following, that Alan Francis's DSM-IV came out in 1994, the following year. So he was, at that point, certainly considered the most powerful psychiatrist in the world because he had headed the DSM, and because he was part of that establishment, in that sense, the most important psychiatrist in the world. You should have been, Peter, but that power was so much resided in the APA and their DSM. And so here's what happened. The very year after Alan's DSM-IV was published, there is a lot of email that went between Dr. Francis and Janssen Pharmaceuticals people, and here's what it was about. Alan was in speaking for himself and two other psychiatrists, Dr. Dougherty and Dr. Kahn, one from Cornell, one from Columbia, and he's saying to the Janssen Pharmaceuticals people, we're going to help you market Risperdal. And here's how we're going to do it. We're going to write a practice guideline for treating schizophrenia because the FDA had approved Risperdal to treat schizophrenia. And now if you say ahead of time, we're going to write a practice guideline, which is what therapists are supposed to use to know what is the best treatment for somebody who's given this label, never mind how problematic that label is, then you ought to be basing these recommendations for treatment on what good research has revealed to be helpful. Well, in order to say that the kind of drug that Risperdal was the best kind of drug to treat people with this label, and that Risperdal was the best of those to use, you had to ignore the science, you had to distort the science, and the point is that before they wrote those practice guidelines, Alan Francis was corresponding with Janssen about this was a marketing tool. So what happened was Janssen Pharmaceuticals said it would pay Alan and his two colleagues almost $500,000 to create this practice guideline. And if they did it fast, they would get tens of thousands of dollars more as a bonus. So they did it fast. So they got almost $500,000. And then Alan is immediately after that corresponding again with Janssen and saying that he and his two colleagues have now constituted themselves as EKS, Expert Knowledge Systems. And he said, so here's what we're going to do, EKS. For another almost $500,000, we will create a marketing plan for you to get Risperdal bought. And that marketing plan is going to include things like we're going to get well-known psychiatrists to do continuing education courses. But the point of them will be you should use Risperdal. And we're going to get in touch with people like they got in touch with the head of the state of Texas's mental health department and the prison system, and they're going to get them to recommend bringing in Risperdal in large quantities. And that's what they did. And the other part of their marketing plan, or another part, was, and we get all these journal articles produced about Risperdal should be used. Now, here's why this is a problem. There are a lot of reasons. One is, when you've got the world's most powerful psychiatrist creating this spurious, unscientific practice guideline in order for the drug company to be able to sell a lot of these pills, the conflict of interest, the corruption, I have called this the most stunning conflict of interest and instance of corruption in the modern mental health system. I mean, I guess it's hard to choose which is the worst, but to have the king of diagnosis in bed with Janssen Pharmaceuticals and creating a marketing plan is just appalling. And you know what? If this had been done out in the open, on the up and up, it wouldn't be on the up and up, but out in the open, at least straightforwardly, it would be bad enough. But the secrecy surrounding it was really damaging. And what you find is that Alan Francis, in his book and in all sorts of articles, he's trashing the DSM-5, and then he's contrasting it with how great, how scientific his DSM-4 was. Well, I was on those committees. Nothing could be further from the truth. But a lot of people think that he is the white knight because he now, if you watch, he only speaks out against diagnosis in the DSM-5, not from the DSM-4, which ruined millions of people's lives. And then he says repeatedly that he will admit that there were three categories were the subject of epidemics, diagnostic epidemics, and those were bipolar disorder in children, autism, and ADHD. But he says, but he and his DSM-4 colleagues could not possibly have foreseen this. Well, I'll tell you something. He blames the drug companies. He blames the parents of the kids who got diagnosed. He blames the media, everybody but taking responsibility for him on himself. And when you, it's hard to tell from the Rothman report, did Alan Francis actually decide what should be the subjects of the various journal articles that came out as part of the marketing plan? Or did he just say, get a bunch of different journal articles published and then leave it to them? But what is clear is that the journal articles ended up recommending Risperdal not only for schizophrenia, for which it had been approved, but, you know, there are all sorts of problems with that anyway, but also for memory problems in old people, bipolar disorder in adults and in children, misbehavior in kids, conduct disorder, that sort of thing. The list goes on and on and on. Autism, ADHD. So all of these categories that led to epidemics that Dr. Francis says his DSM-4 colleagues and he himself could not possibly have foreseen, whether they came directly from what EKS systems recommended or somewhat more indirectly, the fact is that their involvement was absolutely fundamental to all the harm that was done. Risperdal is one of the most dangerous drugs with the most horrible negative effects. And then I just want to say, and then I'm sorry to talk so much, I want to say one other thing. When I wrote this article, which is called Diagnosis Gate, and it's also in the journal Aporia, I was really puzzled because when I read the Rothman report, I thought, how come I've never heard about these practice guidelines and the marketing plan and that sort of thing? And so I did some research to try to find if anybody had written about it. And I found 5 articles in major publications, including Bloomberg, including, I think, Dallas Morning News. And these articles were about the Texas people's involvement with Janssen and the marketing of Risperdal. But not one of these articles included any mention of the first cause, the fundamental, the foundation of the whole marketing scheme, which was the set of practice guidelines that Dr. Francis and his colleagues got almost $1 million to write and then put together the marketing plan. So, you know, Peter, I've tried to figure out I used to be a journalist. If I were going to write about the Rothman Report, and all the stuff that I've been talking about is in about the first 20 pages of it, what would lead me never to mention the practice guidelines or the EKS marketing plan? And I don't really know the answer, but it's a mystery, and it's very disturbing. And all I can tell you is that good journalism practice would include, if I were going to name someone in one of these articles in a major medium, I would have to call them for a comment. So maybe journalists were going to write about it and call them for comments, and then somehow their names didn't get published. I don't know. I know that when I wrote the Diagnosis Gate paper, I thought the public needs to know about this, to know about this corruption and the dangers. And I thought, well, maybe when this is published in an academic journal, which it was, maybe the media will pick up on this and write about it and warn people. And they haven't. The only thing that happened was that Alan Francis wrote this really scurrilous so-called reply to my article. My article was totally, you know, scrupulously documented. But his was just a very personal and, as many people pointed out, very sexist attack full of things that just were completely untrue, when what he should have said was, yes, I did do that, and I was wrong. You know, I think that coming clean would have been admirable, but that's not what happened.
Did Alan Francis publish that as a blog on Madden America?
No, what he did was, he and I are both bloggers for Psychology Today, so I wrote and tried to publish a little thing about my Diagnosis Gate paper, and Psychology Today took it down. And they said, you are writing something critical about one of our other bloggers. And I thought, oh, well, I was writing something true and well documented, but I'm not allowed to write anything critical. Well, then it turns out Alan took his screed and tried to post it on Psychology Today, and they made him take it down because I'm one of their bloggers. But then he immediately published it on the Huffington Post. And, you know,
oh, yeah,
I read
that's
it and
right,
I thought,
yeah.
Pardon?
They're very pro-psychiatry at Huffington Post. I'm a blogger there because I had, you know, had a relationship, both Ginger and I, with Arianna Huffington and helping her with many of her articles in the past. And so I was like a founding blogger, but they're very pro-psychiatry there.
Well, yes. And you know, when his so-called reply was posted, I read it and I thought, oh, this is absurd. Somebody said to me, well, it's libelous. And then a lawyer said to me, well, it's not libelous because you're not famous. So apparently I have no reputation that could be damaged by this. But I was just going to ignore it because who wants to play in the mud, you know? And then colleagues kept writing to me and saying, this is awful. You've got to get things taken down.
By the way, that's false legal advice, I think, Paula.
Pardon?
That's not correct legal advice. If, as far as I know, the fact that you were not, that the lawyer didn't consider you a public figure, set the standards for libel lower. You had more of a chance for a libel suit. It's the public figures.
I see what you're saying.
Because
well,
I know it's very hard for me to sue for libel.
I didn't want to go to court. You know, I just wanted to... Yeah. Focus my energies on things that matter, and who wants to have a spat with him. I just wanted the truth to get out and people to be warned so that they don't go into a therapist's office thinking this is all science.
I understand
and
that.
No
yeah.
conflict of interest, and they're going to help me as soon as they diagnose me and get me on these drugs. I just want to prevent harm. But I'll just tell you this one quick thing about the Huffington Post, because so many colleagues were writing. I finally wrote to the Huffington Post. I wrote to their legal department and didn't get an answer. And I wrote to whoever's the head of their bloggers and said, I'm writing because many colleagues have said they wonder why the Huffington Post would allow this very absurd and just wild personal attack to go up and stay up.
And also, people have said, will you allow a response to be posted? I never heard from either from the legal counsel or from the blogger. And I just moved on to do other things. And, you know, this wouldn't matter if it weren't about somebody who has such power and whom people trust, because those people who think, oh, he was opposed to diagnosis. No, he was opposed to the DSM-5 people, but he thinks psychiatric diagnosis is still fine, except when he's saying it's not fine. You know, he'll say one thing one time and another thing another time, and he's still, in his public appearances, as I document in the Diagnosis Gate article, he's continuing to say, we need to find those people who need to be on the antipsychotic drugs and get them on them. So that's not a change. What he recently was allowed to publish in Mad in America, and I was sort of stunned because I know what Bob Whitaker thinks of Alan Francis, and he has intensively critiqued Alan and held him to the truth. In any case, they recently published an article he wrote about how bad it is to give children drugs. Of all people to be saying this. And there was nothing published with that saying that actually he's advocated for drugs, and he's, you know, been in league with one of the major drug companies. So I just worry about all the people's lives who have been ruined because these truths have not gotten out there.
Let me ask you, have you looked into Joseph Biederman? For the folks who don't know who he is, Biederman is a Harvard psychiatrist, the head of their pediatric psychopharmacology group. Can you imagine that, folks, a pediatric psychopharmacology group? And Biederman created the diagnosis of childhood bipolar disorder, made it up out of whole cloth, applied it to just about anything, and that resulted in a, remember whether it was a 40%, some huge increase in the diagnosing children over a few years, and just huge, and of drugging them. And he, too, was taking money from Johnson & Johnson,
and he, too,
was pushing Risperdal. Do you know much about that?
I'm sorry, what?
Do you know much about that, and can you relate it to this other story that also involves the same drug company and same drug?
Well, yeah, I know that, you know, there's this now famous article that Dr. Gary Greenberg wrote in Wired that was based on his interviews with Dr. Francis, and that was the one in which Francis was famously quoted as saying psychiatric diagnosis is bullshit. So that's what he believes, except when he doesn't believe it. Anyway, and in that very article, and I write about this in the Diagnosis Gate paper, you hear Dr. Francis saying how unfortunate it was that Dr. Biederman ended up doing all of this prescribing and advocating the prescribing of this drug for childhood bipolar disorder. And I'm sitting there thinking, again, I want to make it clear, I don't know if part of Alan Francis's marketing plan was that someone should say that childhood bipolar disorder exists and responds well to Risperdal. I just know that he and his colleagues said, we've got to get a lot of journal articles published. And then what happened was all these articles were published, and each one about, oh, and here's another use for Risperdal, and here's another diagnosis for which you should use Risperdal. So I thought that, you know, if since that practice guideline for treating schizophrenia with Risperdal, since that was apparently the first major step of the whole Risperdal marketing campaign, I think it remains to be found out whether Dr. Francis was directly involved in getting childhood bipolar disorder conceived of and then pushed for Risperdal or not. But I think it would have been much harder without this whole marketing plan to legitimize risperdal for all sorts of things. It would have been much harder without that for Biederman to do the damage that he's done.
It's amazing that one drug company is involved in what are probably the two most shameful buying of leading doctors in the world, psychiatrists in the world.
Yeah. I mean, every time I hear something on the radio that it's sponsored by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, it turns out they are connected with Johnson & Johnson. That's some of the same people. And, you know, the fact that when the Rothman report was first made public a few years ago, none of the major media covered what we're talking about that was in it, that we're talking about today. And the thing, when my article about that uncovered material came out, still, I have a media list of something like 125 people, and each one of them is a journalist that's on my list because they at some point reached out to me to interview me about something in the world of psychology and psychiatry, and often it was diagnosis. So when the article Diagnosis Gate came out, I sent it to all of them. I didn't get a single response, a single even inquiry from any of them. And so I think that just shows the major media still depend on drug company advertising and on the goodwill of the psychiatric and psychological establishment. So that's the only way I can explain the failure.
Well, there are also many of them are on drugs. Probably 2/3 of the people you were writing to were on psych drugs.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Oh, and I want to mention something else. Speaking of psych drugs, you know, there was this new drug that was just approved to treat women's so-called sexual problems.
Oh, and, yes. I'd love to hear you comment on that.
Pardon?
I'd love to hear you comment on that. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, actually, I did an interview with a Slovenia radio show, and so it was just very interesting because they have long segments, so I got to say a lot, and it's on my Facebook page. But one of the things that I did not think of, and you know, shame on me for not thinking of it, but Amy Smith is this wonderful activist and psychiatric survivor who lives in Colorado. Here's what she said to me. I had said all sorts of things like they're calling it the female Viagra, but Viagra and Cialis and all those drugs for men increase blood flow to the penis. But the one drug that gets approved for women's alleged sexual problems works on the brain. Now, as the drug companies have admitted, all these drugs that work on the brain, their effects are unknown. They're unpredictable. They're tremendously dependent on the individual's chemistry. They work and then they stop working, or then they start having the opposite effect of the one they had at the beginning. And I said, you know, to say that women's lack of interest or diminished interest in sex must mean we need to fix their brains. Well, first of all, a lot of women's sexual problems is because they were sexually traumatized. Some of it is because the way women are socialized to feel about sexuality, to have mixed feelings, to have negative feelings about it. And a lot of it is because of their sexual partners not being particularly sensitive or caring. But instead of addressing those issues, we say, so let's do something to the brain. And the something, it's about that nonspecific. I said that to give people this kind of drug is sort of like saying, let's stick a fork in their brain and stir, and maybe something will happen. And Amy Smith said to me after I finished my rant about all sorts of things that were wrong with this drug, she said, well, and you know, Paula, you know who's going to be put on this drug a lot? Will be all these people who are already on psychiatric drugs that reduce sexual arousal and sexual interest. And then they're going to be put on this drug to fix that. And it's another psychiatric drug. I thought, oh, my God, in all the debate and all the criticism about this drug being approved. I never heard anybody say that, but I'm sure she's absolutely right.
Oh, it may even have been thought up that way once they realized this enormous market of, figures like 20% of women on antidepressants, darn near means that 20% of them, of women, have lost their sexuality.
That's right. And Peter, so what you're, so you're talking about the financial incentive for the drug companies and
the market.
I don't know if you've heard that the day after the FDA approved this drug to treat women's so-called sexual problems, the drug company that was making it was sold for $1 billion to a drug company, I believe, in Canada.
Wow.
So there you go. There's the financial incentive right there.
No, I hadn't heard that. That's just amazing.
Yeah, it's nauseating.
It's all about
really
the money.
Yeah, it sure is.
I had a good show with Bob Whitaker where we talked about the enormous social implications in our society. I think the last two-thirds of the show were about that. Do you want to just explore some more in regard to women in particular, the implications of this drug inundation of our culture?
Well, yes, sure. Let me tell you, and if I can sort of embed that in a more general thing,
sure,
too, that I want people to know about. When I started hearing, starting in the late 80s when I became involved in challenging psychiatric diagnosis, when I started hearing from more and more people about how their lives were destroyed, sometimes it was by the psychiatric drugs, sometimes it was because they got a label, any label from the DSM, adjustment disorder, premenstrual disorder, and because they were then officially considered mentally ill, they lost custody of their children. Or people lost the right to make decisions about their medical and legal affairs. Or people would be brought into an emergency room and something horrible seemed to be happening to them physically. And as soon as the attending physician or the doctor on duty saw on their chart that they had a diagnosis of something psychiatric, then immediately they're switched to psychiatry. It's assumed to be imagined. It's assumed to be, oh, they're just complaining because they want attention, or, they're nuts. And people have died or almost died from that. So I think that the bad drug effects are the ones that people are most likely to know about. But every time I think I've heard all of the possible kinds of harm that come from psychiatric diagnosis, I hear about yet another one.
Well, let me interrupt a second. One of the things that I've been writing about in recent years, and that is now, there's just no doubt about it, which is that almost every psychoactive substance, all the psychiatric drugs, produce chronic brain impairment. In the long run, they are reducing brain function. They're often causing atrophy of the brain. They're reducing quality of life. And they're swelling the roles of the disabled.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And of course, that Bob Whitaker documented that so beautifully. And what I love, what I love about Bob Whitaker's work is that he used the data from the World Health Organization and the National Institute of Mental Health. So nobody can accuse him of using data from sort of crazy fringe group. I mean, these were middle of the road establishment organizations. But
Bob documented the long-term disability beautifully, but working on convincing him to more openly talk about the chronic brain damage, which I've been talking about for decades.
That's so important. So here's what struck me. A few years ago, I thought, everybody is upset about all these financial giants in the United States that because they were so minimally regulated, pretty much destroyed our economy. And it struck me that psychiatric diagnosis is completely unregulated, so it's even less regulated than these financial giants. And I've been trying for decades to find lawyers who would work with me and taking on cases. I think the APA should be sued for false advertising with the DSM. They should be made to pay for the harm that has resulted from the marketing of their product, the DSM. They made $100 million from the DSM-4. They haven't used a cent of that to redress any harm that was done or to try to prevent future harm. I said some years ago there should be a black box warning on every copy of the DSM, on every one of their advertisements, on every one of their associated products that goes something like this. The DSM is not grounded in good scientific research. Getting a label from here will not reduce your suffering, and getting a label from here will carry enormous risks of harm. They haven't done that. So because I haven't been able to find lawyers who can afford to go up against the APA, and of course pharma will kick in with them, and who are willing to do it, I was talking to the wonderful Jim Gottstein, the great attorney with Psych Rights, and he said, well, I think the way to go is to file ethics complaints against the APA. So I put out a call just informally for people whose lives had been ruined or damaged because of getting a diagnosis. And we filed nine complaints with the ethics department of the APA. And people who want more information about this can write to me, because if I start talking about it, I want to tell you all of the important information, but you can write to me at Paula Kaplan with a C, paulakaplan@gmail.com, and I can even send you a couple of the complaints that were filed. But basically what we were doing was we were saying to the APA, you as an entity, the APA, and your heads of the DSM committees and work groups, and your presidents and members of the board, have been responsible for failing to meet the APA's own ethical standards, specifically that you base your work on what the science shows, and you flagrantly actually ignore that when it comes to putting together the DSM, and that the patient's welfare should be paramount. And that's just not the case when you're creating this DSM, when you're falsely advertising it, and when none of you people came out publicly and said the truth about it. Because if you had, then so much suffering could have been avoided. If any, the people who came forward and wanted to file complaints were all women. I don't know why, but they were all very brave to do this. And if any one of those women walking in to see a therapist because of whatever was happening in their lives, their mother was dying or something terrible happened to them when they were at university or whatever. If a therapist had said to them, well, you have bipolar disorder or you have borderline personality disorder, if they had known that there's no scientific research behind it and that getting the diagnosis wasn't going to be helpful to them and could cause them all kinds of harm, then a lot of them would have walked out of the office and looked for real help elsewhere. And they didn't know to do that because the wool is pulled over the eyes of the public by the APA. We also asked in all of the complaints that they do a number of things, including, you know, the FDA is now requiring drug companies to collect information about adverse reactions and to make that public. Well, the APA should be required to make known the adverse reactions, the harm that comes from the use of the DSM. We asked them to spend at least some of the $100 million in profits from the DSM-4 to redress some of the harm and to put black box warnings on and so on. Well, predictably, the APA dismissed all of the complaints, didn't make a single comment about the merits of any of them. And certainly, you know, they could have dismissed all the complaints but taken some of the actions we requested, but they didn't. And then an attorney, Wendy Murphy, who's a brilliant feminist attorney in Boston, said, well, now you go to the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Health and Human Services in the federal government. And so five of the complainants filed complaints. And in those complaints, just real briefly, what they said was, under the Americans with Disabilities Act, one form of discrimination is if you don't have a disability, but you're treated as though you do. Now, all of these women, by no stretch of the imagination, I mean, everybody knows there's not a good definition of mental illness, but none of these women, by any stretch of the imagination, should have been considered to have a mental illness. Yet because of the DSM, they were diagnosed as though they had mental illnesses, and their lives were damaged because of this. Well, again, predictably, the Department of Health and Human Services dismissed all the complaints, wouldn't take any action on them, wouldn't make any comment about their merits. So, Peter, what's important about this is we now don't have to just stand up and claim that psychiatric diagnosis is entirely unregulated. We now have a hard copy paper trail that the two entities that by all rights ought to be providing some regulation, that is the APA, which is legally a lobby group and profits phenomenally from their product, the DSM, they won't regulate it, nor will the federal government entity that should be providing some regulation. So if people will go to change.org, there are two petitions on there that I'd love for them to consider signing. One, you find by typing in endorse the call for congressional hearings about psychiatric diagnosis. And the other one is boycott the DSM.
Good work. Great energy. One of the areas that is most clear or most appalling to me about the whole diagnosis issue is what happens to a child who's diagnosed with ADHD. And mm-hmm. Ginger first came across some of these studies, and then we started to pull them out of the literature. But there's a bunch of follow-up studies now from the 1970s with the original cohort of children from Long Island Jewish Hospital, and some of the New York City schools were involved, medical schools, tracing these children now who are in their 40s. And these kids who had very, very mild hyperactivity watch for hitting your buttons, okay?
I'm sorry.
wakes me up, but I'm already awake. This is a good show. But anyhow, these boys, they're all boys, were sent to a free clinic. And there they were studied by this cohort of doctors that have gone on studying them for years. And they weren't reported by their families, who didn't actually think that they were hyperactive in most cases. And it was just a really mild thing and a massive experiment. These people in their 40s have higher rates of suicide, higher rates of incarceration, higher rates of drug addiction, shorter lives, and lower quality of lives on every measure. And finally, they have increased atrophy of the brain. And this is not, of course, from per se the label. That can't cause brain damage. Let me finish.
I'm sorry.
And it isn't from just the Ritalin, which they literally were getting Ritalin. It's because they became career mental patients, and these drugs have ruined their lives. Go ahead.
And I know Bob Whitaker has said that often kids who were put on Ritalin, or people who were put on Ritalin as kids, then later get diagnosed with bipolar disorder and then put on the neuroleptic drugs as well. And what bothers me, and this applies to the example you just gave and to so much that you read about in the media, is that whenever you see that something awful is happening, that there's a high suicide rate or a high rate of early deaths or whatever, then it's really easy to say, like somebody would say about what you just described, oh, well, they were mentally ill. That's what caused all of this. They killed themselves. Therefore, they were mentally ill. And you can tell they were mentally ill because, look, they were diagnosed with ADHD. instead of thinking what was done to them in the mental health system that led to this. And when you hear that Robin Williams committed suicide, well, it's apparently well documented that he was on three different psychoactive drugs, and at least two of them, as I understand it, are known to increase the rates of suicide. So why are people saying, oh, look at him, you know, you could tell years ago he was this tormented genius and he was going to kill himself. It was the mental illness. You think, wait a minute. How come we're not saying maybe it was the drugs?
It's quite astonishing. The Aurora shooter, I've mentioned on an earlier show, you may not know this, Paul, because it's been so hidden. The Aurora shooter who committed those horrible atrocity in the theater and who recently was found guilty. They wouldn't give him not guilty by reason of insanity. And then he was sentenced to life imprisonment because one juror was, and I agree with the death, against the death penalty. One juror didn't want him to have the death penalty. He, when he first went to see the psychiatrist, she immediately thought he was potentially violent, and she put him on Zoloft. So during the entire time that he was evolving his worst craziness, he was already deeply disturbed and potentially violent. But during the time when he began to buy guns, make plans, and go off the deep, deep, deep end into what looks to me like a manic psychosis, he was on Zoloft for 120 days. And then he stopped the Zoloft when he quit going to the doctor, but I think it was like maybe 20 days later that he committed these crimes. He was already, driven over the edge in a psychotic state by the Zoloft. Well, the lawyers decided not to make the plea, and on that basis at all. Listen, we're finishing up. We have 1 minute left. We're talking, folks, to Paula Kaplan. You can find her, Paula J. Kaplan, easily on Google. Her latest book is When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home. This is another whole interest she has in helping veterans, which we share, and which we didn't get to talk to about today, but we can again at a future time. It's been really good to reconnect with you, Paula Kaplan, and to have you on the radio show.
Great. And I'd love to come back and talk about veterans because people who are devastated by being at war or being raped in the military are being told they're mentally ill because these things upset them. And I think that's immoral to say these are mental illnesses.
It is a form of evil. This whole system is really corrupting society. It's robbing our culture of its sense of responsibility, of being able to be in charge of our lives. And it is creating a whole class of disabled human beings. It is a positively bizarre situation. Again, Paula Kaplan, thank you so much for being on the Dr. Peter Bregenauer Hour.